This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
And this is indeed The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And today we have a double bill. We have two people whose first name is Peter, Peter Fabricius, and then after our mid-hour break, Peter Dirk Ace. We have an embarrassment of riches, and we're going to go serious and then sublimely, maybe not quite so serious. Peter Fabricius is my first guest, known to all of you, I'm sure, not just from this program. He has had a long career as a journalist with the Argus Group. He was a foreign correspondent for them and foreign news editor. And post-retirement from that organization, he's been a special analyst and correspondent and writer for the Institute for Strategic Studies and also a colleague on the Daily Maverick. And Peter and I had the adventure of a lifetime at the G20 in a giant room filled with hundreds of journalists desperately looking for news when we couldn't find much. They held us pretty much under control. But Peter was pretty good about that. He found news even where we didn't. But I want to talk to Peter this morning, not about the G20, but about something else that happened in his neck of the woods in Cape Town. Will to Peace, or Peace of the Will, or whatever they called that thing, the naval exercise that took place just off the coast of Cape Town, False Bay and Simonstown, South Africa, Russia, China, let me get it right, the United Arab Emirates, and then sort of surreptitiously perhaps Iran, which either was or wasn't in the exercise, depending on who you talk to. Peter, I'm delighted to be able to get some of your time. And I think we're talking about naval exercise. I see behind you, you have a reproduction of the famous Hokusai, the great wave off Kanagawa, which seems entirely appropriate for today's conversation. Welcome and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Yeah, tsunami might be more like it. Yeah, thanks, Brooks.
You know, tell me what was this exercise all about? Why was it ostensibly under the BRICS umbrella? And who was or wasn't participating, and how did it get so complicated?
This was initially the third iteration of a series of exercises called MOSI. There's a MOSI 1 in 2019, there was a MOSI 2 in February 2023, which was very unfortunately, by coincidence or design, we don't know, on the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So a lot of people in the U.S. and elsewhere, and here and in South Africa, I must say, we're not very pleased to see us doing military exercises with Russia at that time. And then there was supposed to be MOSI 3 at the time of that G20 summit that you referred to. And then somebody decided, well, this is not such a good time to have a Russia, China, etc. We didn't know about the etc. then doing naval exercises in South Africa when we have all the Western and other leaders of the world here for the G20. So it was postponed. And then something mysterious happened because the defense force then seemed to just take this thing off on a tangent. And it decided to have an exercise, not just of Russia, China, and South Africa, but of the BRICS Plus group. And that's a group that has 10 nations in it, includes Iran and the UAE, which then decided to participate in this new exercise with a new name called, as you were saying, Will for Peace. And when the inquiry that was eventually appointed to look into this reports, we'll presumably find out how it was that the Defense Force managed to sort of hijack this process, actually, in the sense that it wasn't checked out and authorized by the presidency or DIRCO, Department of International Relations. So we believe. So that's where we kind of stand, waiting for the outcome of this inquiry.
And what I spent a lot of time in Japan, and we saw military joint exercises, not every day, obviously, but fairly frequently over a decade. And they usually have a rather specific component of, we're going to train for this or that iteration of a problem or a challenge or an opportunity, whether it's humanitarian rescue, whether it's multidisciplinary joint force exercises, holding off the barbarians or the Ruritanian army or whatever it might be. What was the purpose of this exercise other than to have a bunch of ships in False Bay?
Yeah, you know, that is a good question, because I think that if you look at some exercises that the South African Navy has participated in the past, they have a much more, I think you could say, probably a sort of combat readiness purpose. But I think this one was a little vaguer on that kind of detail, maybe because even the SANDF realized there were some sensitivities. So it was more really about more broadly strengthening multilateral naval partnerships, enhancements of collective maritime capabilities, promotion of mutual understandings. It's hard to actually figure out in the end exactly what they kind of helped each other achieve, you know. I mean, one of the as you would know, that one of the objects of these types of exercises is to increase interoperability, as they call it, just being able to communicate on the same radio wavelengths and so on. So they were a little bit vague about the detail.
Yeah, and it seemed to me, from at least from the short video clips that I did see, courtesy of some of your friends actually, and photos, it didn't seem to me like there was a lot of close order training taking place, as much as leaving a harbor and then sort of coming back into the harbor and then leaving the harbor again.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was announced just at the start of it was a so-called live fire exercise, and they even put out a map which showed you what part of False Bay other shipping should avoid for the 3 days of this exercise. But you know, I kind of drove around a bit and had a look at what was happening there, and as far as one could tell from the shore, and I didn't hear or see any sign of actual firing of guns. So it's this whole thing is kind of fairly covered in murk and murkiness, you know.
Now, if all that's true, and for the sake of argument, I'm pretty sure it is as you say, and we obviously are going to await the report from the government explaining what exactly how it happened and why did it happen the way it did, which I guess is out next week, maybe. What do you think was actually achieved other than confusing civil-military relations, A,
yeah,
and B, not giving a particularly forward boost to interoperability or greater force capabilities other than sailing around a bit?
Look, I mean, from a military perspective, I guess those guys may have learned something from each other, just like a few words in Russian and Iranian, Persian, I suppose. But seriously, it's quite hard to tell, because they seldom do go into that much detail. But your initial point, other than what were the benefits versus the costs of the complexities and the problems that arose, we should just clarify here, which I don't think we've done yet, is that after a lot of questions asked about whether Iran was there or not last week, eventually, and no answers from very clear answers from the Defense Force, apart from a Facebook post which mentioned the Iranians participating, and then was taken down, and questions to the presidency and the DOCO were not answered or to the SNDF. Eventually on Friday, the Minister of Defense issued a statement saying that that she had established a board of inquiry to establish why the explicit instruction of President Ramaphosa, which we believe was given the previous Friday, January the 9th, for Iran not to participate, was not communicated or was not obeyed by the Defense Force. So that is really the gist of that board of inquiry, the results of which we expecting, yeah, as you say, maybe next week. Or...
I mean, that poses a real question about the strength and vitality of civilian control over military activities, which should be very troubling to not just journalists, but I think more broadly and more generally across the board.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely true. I think that is the gist of it. There's been some indications before, funnily enough, also with Iran last August, the chief of the Defense Force, General Rouzani Mapwanya, went off to Tehran and was quoted by the Iranian media as really fully, you know, backing Iran. I mean, and as we know, Iran is in a state of some kind of perpetual conflict with Israel, backed by the US, and generally not terribly well liked in the West, in particular. And there he was as the head of the Defense Force with no mandate, and we subsequently discovered, from the presidency or the Minister of Foreign Affairs, you know, stating full support for everything Iran was doing. So this issue about civilian control of the military has been bubbling for some time. Maybe this now has brought it to a head, and maybe it'll be addressed.
I have to take a break. We have to do some commercial messages and station ID. Otherwise, I get into trouble with my betters at the station, and ICASA will probably have a poster with me wanted on it if we don't do this. So let's take a quick break.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is indeed The Deep Dive, and I am your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, well, two guests, but first we're dealing with the topic of Will to Peace, the naval exercise that took place in False Bay, and all the more delicate political and operational questions that related to that. And there's no one better than Peter Fabricius to bring on board to help us understand this. This question of civilian control of the military, this is not a uniquely South African question. This is dealt with well or badly by almost every country that is under civilian control, but which has a military. And in some ways, the most famous example ever was in 1950. General Douglas MacArthur went against the strictures of the then U.S. President, Harry Truman, not to do certain things in the Korean conflict, and refused to obey, and was promptly fired. And there was an enormous firestorm of protest over this. But looking back at it, it was a crucial moment in ensuring that civilian control was necessarily always preeminent and paramount. Peter, do you expect that South Africa will somehow handle this quietly, and or is it going to be one of these moments where civilians say, these are things that have to be maintained and have to be followed, or else? I mean, are we at that inflection point? Or is this just going, are we going to just go right past this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I must say, I don't really know for sure. It's not Ramaphosa's style, obviously, to to precipitate crises, shall we say. And so it's, I suspect that he's likely to try to deal with it as uncontroversially as possible. You know, you mentioning the firing of MacArthur, there is a possibility, I guess, that that the chief of the South African Defence Force and maybe even the chief of the Navy could get fired. Both of them have got a few black marks against them. I mean, Monde Lebese, the Vice Admiral in charge of the Navy, made some pretty critical remarks last year where he more or less suggested that the cuts by the Treasury in the Defence Force budget could have been designed to frustrate any kind of maritime control over criminal activities, which is a hell of a thing to say for the chief of the Navy. They're not supposed to be that political, and they're not supposed to be that critical of the government. But I suspect that Ramaphosa, being Ramaphosa, will kind of somehow or another gloss over this. You know, I mean, I think there will be some consequences and some discipline and so on, but whether he'll fire anybody, a little bit doubtful.
Maybe the vice admiral and the chief of the defense force will find themselves ambassadors to very small islands in the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah. that has happened before.
Yeah, I was alluding to that, Peter. I'm sort of edging into that a little bit. It's a way of getting rid of people that have been uncomfortable and awkward for a government. I want to just take 1 minute, if I can, cast our eyes toward Davos in Switzerland. And the Board of Peace, you look perplexed, Peter.
Can I just say it again?
I want to cast our attention just for a second at the events in Davos, Switzerland, and the announcement of this very unusual body, the Board of Peace.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear you. Trump is really on another planet. He's now sort of subsumed the role of the United Nations, amongst other things, having awarded himself the Nobel Peace Prize by adroit diplomacy and coercion. I just don't think that project has got much chance of success, to be honest. I mean, look, he did help to bring about a quite significant scaling down of the conflict in Gaza, even if we don't want to initially say that's, you know, complete peace. But, enterprise, that sort of challenge requires much greater credibility than he can bring to that.
You know, I was intrigued because, of all the countries that you would logically see attending such an opening gambit, there were basically no Western democratic nations participating. It looked like countries had decided this was an opportunity somehow to be larger and more visible internationally, and to, dare I say it, curry favor with Donald Trump.
Yeah, he certainly has kind of burnt his bridges with what used to be U.S.'s principal Western allies, hasn't he? I mean, threatening to sort of rip NATO apart by invading Greenland and so on. So, yeah, it's almost like a sort of club of pariahs, you know, but... That's putting it a bit strongly, but as you say, countries that are rather desperate for recognition and support.
Yeah, you won't let me in your club, so I'm going to set up my own counterbalancing club, and we're going to be bigger, stronger, and more visible than your club.
Yeah.
Peter, I'm going to let you go in a sec, but if you have any parting words on will to peace, I'd give you a minute to do that. If there's anything else you need to add for us to understand what happened.
Yeah, you know, I would say on that score that although maybe somebody's going to take the rap as the way, if anyone's going to take the rap, it's somebody, as we know, down the line of the hierarchy. But really, you know, I mean, with great respect, Ramaphosa should have been far more attentive to what his military is doing. I mean, apparently it took a report in the Tehran Times of, you know, December 22 to bring to the attention of the presidency and the Durka that Iran's ships were on the sea already heading for South Africa to participate in this naval exercise. Yeah, so that certainly should have been the defense force that kept him informed. But, you know, we have intelligence authorities that are supposed to be keeping an eye on things as well, you know, and where were they? So I think this has been a failure of government across the board.
Okay, Peter, I'm going to let you go. I'm sure there are things that you need to attend to, but I appreciate this fairly succinct discussion on an issue of real national importance. And when the report is issued and when it's been digested by people like you, perhaps we can do another couple of minutes to sort of look at the implications and after effects of what it says and where things seem to be going.
That'd be great. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, we've been speaking with Peter Fabricius, well-known commentator, experienced journalist, one of the best men in the business. And we will be back after these messages. Craig, you got a station break lined up, yes?